Kia ora, welcome comrades to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. I'm Ani White.
And I'm Derek Johnson. Hola, comrades. This month, we're discussing disability and COVID, a content warning for disability and serious illness, euthanasia, racism, and fascism. But for those unaware, I was hit by a mysterious virus back in July that required my lengthy hospitalization, and it was luckily not COVID. It was theorized to be a weaker one that was floating around because COVID kind of knocked the other viruses out of the way, and there was no flu season this year, so something else hit me. I noticed because I was having trouble, everything was really salty, and I couldn't stop throwing up. So rather than with COVID where you can't taste anything, everything tasted way too salty and burned my mouth, and I couldn't stop throwing up. I was massively weakened. I almost died from my heart going haywire electrically. I kept falling down because of this, and it was making my legs really weak, and I ended up having to go to the hospital, go to the ER. Doctors performed a cardioversion on me where they stopped and restarted my heart. Everything seems mostly reset and fine now. I just had to go through weeks of, you know, PT and QT, the different therapies and stuff. Took my flu shot prior, but whatever this was, it attacked my immune system. My muscular dystrophy made it that way that my muscles were extremely weakened, and therefore I fell down a lot. My cardiovascular system. I know I disappeared for a little while. Thankfully, you had a friend find me.
Yeah, we had to coordinate on Facebook to check out if you were all right. I'm glad you at least, you know, were able to recover in that.
Yeah, I appreciate everybody checking up on me on that one. That was, I noticed how scary it is when you don't have your phone and everything to be online, so terminally online, that you literally can't say to anybody, hey, by the way, I'm in the hospital, you know, and you're like literally cut off from like most people, you know. If anybody thinks I disappeared for like a month there for out of the blue, that's what happened.
Yeah, I ended up somehow digging up your home number and calling from Australia where I was at the time, find out what was happening from your mother. So just disappearing, it was quite a scary situation.
Yeah, it was pretty scary all around. Yeah, the doctors couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. I think it was probably a combination of between the muscular dystrophy and the fact that I have ankylosing spondylitis in my back, that whatever this virus was, it just like hit all of my systems. I had something like this before, and that's why I have a lot of these problems, because I had gotten hit by something in my system and made me fall down. For the rest of my life, I will be hit by viruses, whether they be the flu or COVID or pneumonia, whatever. They will hit my muscles. They will hit a lot of my, you know, my systems and my immunity, and it'll be a bitch to come back from each time and be kind of weak each time, you know. I have to do all this physical therapy and everything. Boy, when they really talk about, you know, compromised immune systems, they're really not kidding. And so the COVID's got me pretty upset and pretty scared by the fact that I literally can't leave the house and go anywhere, and all these people going around refusing to wear masks and refusing to get vaccinated are just making it so I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything, and it's just like driving me nuts. They just couldn't figure out what the hell was wrong with the electricity of my heart and my blood pressure. Everything was through the roof. We're starting to be like, well, you know, if this doesn't go down in a couple days, you know, you might die. I'm like, I'm like the daughter on Bob's Burgers, Tina. I don't know what to say when they tell me this shit, you know?
Yeah, I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Yeah, thanks. So because of what they did with the cardioversion thing, I dodged a pacemaker or worse or slow, you know, and I slowly got better. I just hate that, you know, it's like COVID is just reshuffling what other viruses are competing to get us sick, you know, even if you don't get COVID. It's like an arms race out there if you have low immune systems. None of that worked. They were going to give me like a shock vest that was going to zap my heart if my heart rate sped up or if I had AFib that returned, which was this was, and like I had a worst case, could be open heart surgery, implantation of a pacemaker that would zap me, or death. Again, touch and go there, you know, with my heart rate would not slow down. So they just needed to make sure I did not have blood clots before the cardioversion, because that makes it worse. And then, you know, once I woke up on the other side of this thing, you know, I felt like I went to sleep for 2 seconds and I felt great and felt like everything was a reset button, you know? So it's kind of like with the computer, you know, your computer's not working, turn it off and then back on. And now it's working. Now I'm back home. It was not fun after finally getting through that over the summer. Is in January, my mother caught COVID-19 from a home health aide who was here, who has spread it unknown to herself until she tested negative and did not come in on her usual day. And it seems that she may have caught it from her son, who was working at an infected fulfillment warehouse of a megacorp named after a certain river in South America. He refused to work when he realized the company was making the workers come in with COVID and everybody was sick. And it seemed like he went home, kept himself in his room. He got others sick in the home. And my mom tested positive, and she was placed in quarantine at it's kind of a rehab center. I was advised not to go there. I was advised to get tested, but you know, I couldn't get the paratransit company that was contracted with Uber to take me, because like they said, well, they won't take you to get tested. You know, they'll take you to get tested only for vaccines. No, I'm sorry. They'll take you only for a vaccine. So like the drive share companies will give you a free ride to go get a vaccine, but they won't take you to get tested because I guess you might be sick, you know, if they take you to go get tested and then get the vaccine. So here was a government thing that, you know, I could have gotten to find out if I had it or not myself. So I was waiting for one through the mail, one of the antigen tests, and hopefully I did it right and it looked like I didn't have it. But yeah, that was a stupid policy and a waste that I wasn't able to. Had to wait for like a couple weeks to find out if I had COVID as well. It was hell. Waiting around to find out what was going to happen with my mom's COVID. It was getting a lot of difficulties with the place, which I will get into, as other people have had trouble around the country. That was far worse. So fuck this country, city, state, governor, and country, and the president of the United States. I'm going to remember this as long as I fucking live. How all these administrations just sat back and around in a goddamn circle jerk in the middle of an extinction level event pandemic and just demanded that we went back to work for less money while the rich got richer rather than fight the virus. And may this country be among the first when they all collapse from this and in general. And, you know, anti-vaxxers like TERFs are fascists and are dead on arrival, in my opinion.
One thing you might have seen conspiracy theorists ask is, do you know anyone who's actually had COVID? And for a long time, my answer to that was, I know a lot of people in the US who've had COVID. You being immunocompromised, so particularly susceptible to it. I didn't know many people in New Zealand and was like, isn't that kind of interesting? Doesn't that suggest maybe that the relative policies of the countries might have an impact on whether I know people who have COVID? So the New Zealand government, for all my many criticisms of it, and I could link you to a number of articles I've had criticising the problems of the Ardern government, for all my criticisms of it, it initially did have a reasonably competent public health response to COVID. So the country had only only 1,500 cases in 2020. And while we could attribute some of that to relative isolation and population sparsity, it's also the case that more densely populated countries in East Asia were able to contain the virus with similar policies. So obviously having some kind of a sensible, informed public health response does have a huge impact on how vulnerable people are. And this isn't to say that the government's response has been perfect. The pandemic has certainly exacerbated existing inequalities. So to quote Cronwyn Beachy from Fight Back Aotearoa, while the economy has overall improved, the improvement has not been equally distributed. Some economists refer to the economic recovery as a K-shaped recovery, where those with assets, especially property, are doing well, while those without are struggling. This is due to structural inequality that preceded the pandemic. COVID-19 has made it worse. The housing bubble, which has put owning a home out of reach for most working people, has resulted in a shortage of rental property and a corresponding rise in rents. Calls for the government to do more than tinker around the edges have been ignored. Some amendments to the Residential Tenancies Act, which took effect last year, have improved the rights of tenants, including restricting the number of times rent can be increased during a tenancy, but there has been no attempt to put a cap on rents. While more public housing is being built, there is still 25,000 on this social housing waitlist. While most non-essential office workers and professionals were able to work from home during lockdowns, those in sectors like hospitality or manufacturing have lost jobs or had their hours reduced. Many of them were unable to access support from work and income because they are receiving just enough through wage subsidies to put them over the income limits, but not enough to afford to pay rent or mortgages and buy food. While the government has increased funding to food banks, many are stretched to capacity and food parcels are not a long-term solution to poverty. The government has still not acted on the recommendation of its own welfare expert advisory group in 2019 that benefits be increased to provide a livable income. An increase of $20 per week to main benefits in July 2021 was nowhere enough to cover the increased costs of housing, food, and other necessities. So New Zealand is certainly not a utopia. I've said before that Jacinda Ardern seems like a beacon of light because of the darkness elsewhere in the world, that because the situation is so bad, a relatively competent response while still having many, many problems in terms of capitalism and inequality.
I see some commonalities.
Yeah, there's certainly commonalities.
I see some of the commonalities in housing and the recovery and stuff. What I find interesting, though, is you had a government that, like ours and many others, still did not act on the recommendations for how to do better recovery stuff. It is interesting that this welfare expert advisory group was saying that the benefits be increased to provide a livable income. Or here, it was an uphill battle just for them to even suggest that benefits just be extended rather than, let alone increased. When that was a debate, it should all be means tested and sundowned and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, well, that's a general tendency of politics in this country. We get committees and advisory groups and things formed by governments, which make some quite good recommendations on the, you know, by the standards of policies under capitalism, and then maybe 5%, 10% of those policies will be implemented. It becomes a bit pointless, and I get frustrated when people demand that those sorts of groups be formed, because it's like those sorts of groups have been formed and they've been ignored. So why would we demand more of those groups to sort of make recommendations that aren't implemented? It's a bit like the UN, you know, all these good words on paper that then just don't get enacted. Things have gotten worse since that article was written. That was written before the Omicron spike. So now we've had our biggest COVID surge ever. If you look at the graph back to 2020, the recent spike, which is massive, flattens every previous surge. So it looked like a straight line until this massive spike. And at the peak, we were getting 25,000 new cases a day. And this is, again, compared to 1,500 total in 2020 and in a country of 5 million. So in other countries, 25,000 might not sound like a lot. But in a country of 5 million, that's, you know, a really high proportion of people are being affected. Despite the claims of conspiracy theorists that this was all just an excuse for big government, the government is actually now substantially loosening public health measures and restrictions. So they'd already moved from the lockdown levels system to a more lenient traffic light system based largely around vaccine passes. And now, just past the latest spike, just as the case numbers were starting to go down, but we were still having people regularly dying, the traffic light system has been loosened again. So removing outdoor gathering limits, not requiring masks to be held at outdoor events, increasing indoor gathering limits from 100 to 200, and ditching the requirement to scan in on entering venues. And these are changes made to the red requirements in the traffic light system. So the maximum measures the government is committing to. In other words, cases in the last couple of months were higher than they've ever been, while public health measures looser than they've been since first lockdown. The government's actually going in the opposite direction to what the conspiracy theorists are saying at a time when...
Before you finish that, don't you think it's kind of obvious both our governments that they're ending some of the things that would lessen infection and spread and all these kinds of regulations and requirements? They're ending them before it's going down, thus making it go up higher. How does that stop the disease if you're making an environment for the disease to spread more and to spike and surge?
Yeah, well, when I said they changed the maximum level restrictions, that happened just past the spike. So when I talked to people about it and criticized it, they were like, well, new cases are reducing. And it's like, yeah, but they're reducing from the biggest spike by far that we've had. Cases are still incredibly high. There just weren't as many new cases a day. And at that point, they start to get rid of all of the restrictions, and not only decrease, say, from red to orange in the traffic light system, but actually change red so that they couldn't or weren't committing to the restrictions if, say, there was another surge again. They're actually cutting out their capacity to respond if things get worse again. Just an update since recording this episode, both on the healthcare situation in Aotearoa New Zealand generally, and my own experience with it. So back in April, I had a week of severe headaches. During a particularly crippling headache, I called a helpline and they said to wait to see my GP. I also got a negative from a home RAT, which later turned out to be a false negative. However, the headache lasted all night, around 16 hours total with no sleep, and being Easter, it would be days before I could even book an appointment with the GP. So I went to the emergency department. The first doctor I saw was skeptical, guessing it was related to a minor virus, and saying, quote, "The emergency department is for emergencies." However, fortunately, they decided to run thorough tests, and a CT scan revealed a blood clot in my brain, likely caused by COVID, although the cause is uncertain. I was held in hospital for a week and put on blood thinners. Fortunately, the headaches cleared up over the 2 weeks after my release. I'm lucky the doctors decided to be comprehensive. Another woman with similar symptoms wasn't so lucky. To quote the New Zealand Herald, a, quote, healthy, unquote, 50-year-old woman has died with brain bleed after allegedly being told by staff at Middlemore Hospitals emergency department, there would be an 8-hour wait before she was examined. She was frustrated, so left. She returned at 4 a.m. that same day and was intubated. CT showed a massive subarachnoid hemorrhage and she died. A subarachnoid hemorrhage is a type of stroke and is most commonly caused by a brain aneurysm. An unnamed doctor said if a patient presents with a severe headache, the first thing they want to do is rule out a bunch of conditions that can rapidly kill people, such as meningitis, heart attacks, and a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Note, this contradicts the advice I got that, quote, the emergency department is for emergencies and a severe headache is not an emergency. So back to the article, the unnamed doctor said that the minister needed to acknowledge the country was in a hospital crisis and staff needed to be paid better so they aren't forced to leave the profession they love, close quote. So there are two problems here. There is, as this doctor said, an overstretched and underfunded healthcare system, something that was the case before COVID, but is worse now. And frankly, another problem is doctors' arrogance in dismissing certain kinds of symptoms as hysteria. Given the systemic problems, they are forced to rank patients based on prejudgments, which may be erroneous. And again, fortunately, I was luckier than the woman at Middlemore Hospital with similar symptoms. Aotearoa New Zealand is now seeing a new spike of COVID cases, and if the healthcare system continues to be chronically underfunded and overstretched, we will see more tragedies resulting from this kind of systemic negligence.
Essentially, the government is now relying on vaccination and masking to a significant degree, not really on other measures. And to a point, this makes sense. So 96% of eligible New Zealanders are vaccinated. Unvaccinated New Zealanders are 12 times as likely to be hospitalized. So obviously, vaccines do significantly reduce the amount of symptoms, much more than they reduce transmission. It's about 3 times with transmission and 12 times with symptoms and hospitalization. It ultimately seems to be more of a political calculus than a public health calculus. So the government no longer has the sense of political consensus it managed to achieve in 2020. The messaging in 2020 was very effective. They talked about a team of 5 million. There was broad public support for the lockdown. But now we've had similar convoys to what other countries have had. So Parliament lawn was occupied for a number of weeks. People shut down traffic in the surrounding areas. It's not a majority of the country that's against these measures, but it's a vocal.
And we saw the people in Canada were AstroTurf paid by the Koch brothers and other billionaires and oil people here in America.
We have similarly elite actors pulling the strings. Mostly, so you have figures like John Ansell, who's a sort of white supremacist conspiracy theorist, and Brian Tamaki, who's a Christian fundamentalist. Kyle Chapman, he's not so much wealthy, but is like a long-standing neo-Nazi. And a lot of these people are playing a significant role behind the scenes. They actually did a relatively good job of the people who are visible not being obviously far right. They sort of had the mums movement part of it, for example. They also sort of played on themes of Māori sovereignty and used images of Māori sovereignty. There's a certain amount of vaccine skepticism among a number of Māori. So they actually, despite the people with the most power in the movement being essentially far right figures, they were quite good at the people who actually face it, the cops and the media, being the people who could market the movement more effectively. Even so, it was still very cranky and very strange, and a lot of the signs were, and claims that people were making were bizarre. They managed to a certain degree confuse the message and make it not appear to be a far-right message. Obviously, the claim was that it was anti-mandate, not anti-vax, but about 80% of people there weren't vaccinated. So that sort of collapses, especially when they were also harassing people wearing masks, not wearing masks themselves. Even if you could make a case for, you know, masks and vaccination should be voluntary, they weren't voluntarily doing things and they were actively against the people who were. So the whole anti-mandate slogan, which was kind of the main slogan, was really obscuring what this was, which is an anti-public health movement with far-right elements essentially pulling the strings, some of them very wealthy far-right elements, some of them not so much. I mean, Labour didn't pander to them in an obvious way, but you've had that kind of backlash, and then you've had from the start also the kind of market junkie backlash that anything that slows down the market is unacceptable. And it seems a lot more like Labour's calculus is a political calculus than a public health calculus. It doesn't make sense to me to be getting rid of restrictions at a time when the pandemic is worse than it's ever been. So they're backing down, as Labour tends to. Whenever Labour looks like it's doing something good, it doesn't tend to last. It's just their pattern, like a lot of Labour parties.
Sounds like the Democrats too.
Yeah. So as in other countries, a militantly vocal minority has again taken an anti-public health stance. This is typified by a comment I saw, and this is particularly horrible. Someone saying that sacrifices for immunocompromised people who are going to die soon anyway aren't worth it. Pretty raw, ugly statement. And granted, it was just some random. But aside from the disgusting social Darwinism, I also think this notion that every immunocompromised...
Wow. Audible Marge growl.
Yeah. It's saying it's acceptable for friends of mine to die. Oh. This notion that every immunocompromised person is knocking on death's door is also a misconception. So many with underlying conditions live full, long lives.
It wouldn't be getting sick if you assholes would just wear masks and take a goddamn vaccine. Ooh, that's the thing, though. Sorry to jump in here with my rant, because that just pissed me off so much. Can you speculate on why they're so afraid of getting a shot? Because a shot's like 2 seconds.
I don't know, but I had the same thought when I got my booster, that there's so much hype and political intensity around this, but then sitting down and just getting the shot, it's over in a moment. This is such a politicized thing, but it's actually very little effort. I think there's many factors. I think there's a kind of weird, entangled idea of like bodily autonomy, libertarianism, autonomy from social obligations, from healthcare, and from any sense of kind of living in a society where your actions might affect other people. That's how I, as best I can explain it.
Yeah, I could buy there that's stupid, but the idea that so many people are that evil and that they don't care how their actions affect other people, especially children and elderly, to put them to the point of risking their lives and killing them. I mean, like we say here in this country, the Republicans at this point are literally a fucking death cult. They want to die. It's very strange. But it's like, but you don't have the bodily autonomy to have an abortion, though, or to be gay or to be trans or anything, you know?
When you say they want to die, yeah, that idea of sovereignty from healthcare, I find quite mind-bending. I mean, the sovereign citizen stuff is kind of the extreme of all this, the idea of the individual.
You can't give me a speeding ticket. I know maritime law, you know?
yeah.
Well, you know, you'd think that social Darwinism, you know, you always thought it was for other people, not for them too, though, you know? I guess they figure they're not going to get sick too, and they're not going to die too. So they figure they don't care that other people would get sick. And they figure, like other social Darwinists or with religious prosperity gospel types, they figure that, you know, God favors them and people who get sick and die, well, it's their fault that they die. But, you know, social Darwinism's been a part of both religious right and the capitalist movement in this country, you know, since the 20s.
And even if the government isn't using this kind of explicitly social Darwinist language, I think its policies suggest a similar calculus that immunocompromised people can be sacrificed. Disability rights lawyer Huhana Hickey has noted how tightening resources during this period have impacted disabled people. Quote, "Yesterday, a social worker told a 70-year-old woman who is disabled, who has cataract, who is brain injured, who's caring for her mother, and she was going home yesterday, and she said to her, 'Well, put the referral in, but you won't be getting any carer supports for about 2 to 3 months because we can't do it.' As of yesterday morning, they had cut those services. So even in a country with public health care, you know, there's still a lot of people who don't have access to that healthcare in practice. Quoting again, "Very scared for our community. I would definitely recommend any disabled person that does get COVID or get sick with anything else, go in by ambulance. Don't go in yourself and wait in that line because that's far too dangerous," close quote. And she said when resources became tight, it felt like disabled people were left to fend for themselves. And I think that's definitely the calculus that we're seeing now, that, well, most people are vaccinated, and if most people get the virus, they probably won't be hospitalized. That's sort of accepting that a certain amount of people are going to be immunocompromised and are going to be a lot more in danger than most people who get the vaccine. Anyone opposed to masking and vaccination in this context is essentially, basically, whether they know it or not, they're encouraging eugenics, I think.
I think so. And I think our government is carrying out a policy institutionally and, you know, structurally, whether on purpose, whether on accident. But it sure as hell turns out that, like, when certain people die from this disease, gee, who's the ones being most affected? Disabled, elderly, Black, Native, tribes people. You know, if you were doing a genocide, I mean, these are the same exact targets you'd be going for. What a coinkydink. You know, that's a very good advice that the disability activist said there. They got that feeling that they're right to be scared, as am I. And in this country, what's fucked up is, like, when I went in the ambulance to go to the hospital here, you know, we have a lot of both police, firefighters, and paramedics that don't believe in getting vaccinated. So you go into the ambulance, the fuckers have COVID and get you sick, taking you to the hospital.
Were there any vaccine mandates in healthcare? Because they have been here.
Well, there was no. There were at some levels, like doctors, but like at nursing homes, though, they were allowing the nurses and the CNAs in them all to have a conscious objection and be like, "Well, I refuse to take the vaccine, therefore you have to get tested every week." So they were working with elderly people who were low, you know, compromised immunity, and they were exposing them to COVID and back and forth, you know, and they were getting the other employees exposed as well, and the residents of the nursing homes. And we saw how nursing homes were used to store sick people, Cuomo in New York and in New Jersey as well. But I think they are trying to take out the old, though. The way they're intentionally putting sick people in with the elderly, or taking elderly people, kicking them out of the hospital and sending them to the nursing home to be around all the other elderly people. I mean, you kind of know what's going to happen, whether you're not doing it on purpose or not. Yeah, that's neglect.
And one thing I mentioned, they're getting rid of so many social distancing requirements here. They're also getting rid of a bunch of vaccine mandates, although they're keeping them for certain key areas, but they're getting rid of a lot of the vaccine mandates. One thing people don't realize a lot, because there's so much focus on the restrictions and whether the requirements to get vaccines are ethical or what have you. There were a lot of places that were restricted from asking for a vaccine pass. So the way the traffic light system works is either you're required to ask for a vaccine pass or you're restricted from it. So for example, public transport was restricted. I can sort of understand the rationale for that in terms of people having access to services. But then you had, for example, the long distance trains just suspended their services because they said the fact that they weren't allowed to ask for vaccine passes was kind of unacceptable risk. So there's so much focus on requirement to ask for a vaccine pass, but not on the requirement to not. That I think there's a lot in what the government is doing that's sort of being missed in the almost culture war framing of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's so fucked up is that here it was always voluntary, even once it became a mandate and that time where it was going to run out of time, and then doctors and nurses and stuff, people in certain industries were going to either have the choice to voluntarily vaccinate or get tested constantly. That's all they were going to have to do. And yet it went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court knocked it down, and they almost made it that doctors and nurses didn't have to be vaccinated, but the rest of the Supreme Court overruled the crazy people, kept it in there. But could you imagine going in for a heart surgery or any kind of surgery and stuff, and you got nurses and doctors that refuse to take the vaccine that are actively have COVID? What would be the point of going to the hospital at that point? To die? But you know, when the truck people tried to start that crap down here, they were like, "We're against the mandate," but there was no mandate here by the time they did that. The Supreme Court ruled can't have a mandate where somebody has no choice but to. They were protesting against nothing. Like, you know, it's like Seinfeld, a show about nothing here. It petered out because there was nothing to be against.
Yeah, well, one thing is with the sort of the transnational nature of this far right with the internet, that people are replicating the exact same messages in different places, regardless of what the context is.
Yeah, they didn't think to edit the messages a little bit between the Canada version and the America version.
Yeah, we have a lot of people who are essentially copying and pasting stuff from the American far right and using it here, like sometimes literally just using the same material.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that really got me was that really made me click that, yeah, this is fucking genocide or democide, is that the CDC, and they've since apologized since disability activists called them on it. The head of the CDC talking on television to some reporter saying that it's better now, and like, you know, the numbers are better as far as new cases and people dying of it, because the only people dying and getting it are like disabled people with compromised immune systems and comorbidities and stuff. So, you know, like, it's okay that they're all dying, you know, it's only disabled people dying, you know. And they had to apologize for that, because it's like, okay, so they're trying to spin all these deaths, maybe 1,000 a day or so, that the disease is going down more than it is, or that it's less of a problem. So what do? They give us eugenics, you know? I mean, that they don't see that they're arguing proactively eugenics.
And they're saying the quiet part out loud, because I was saying the New Zealand government, which is very messaging conscious, isn't saying that sort of thing. But I think there is that kind of calculus that's happening around what's an acceptable sacrifice, guided by a political calculus, not by a public health calculus, I think. And by political, I mean playing the game.
Exactly. I don't get it. And I mean, I guess basically what's happening is that it wasn't enough that the billionaires got even the Bezoses and the Elon Musks and everybody got richer during this whole thing while everybody was stuck at home and was losing their jobs and working on Zoom. But they wanted us to go back to work for less pay. And they didn't want to give anybody any kind of child care, so they wanted to send everybody's kids back to crowded schools to get it and then come home and get the parents sick and the grandparents sick. And it's just like, just to make extra profit. And it's like, a society, a civilization like that really doesn't deserve to live. Because, I mean, it can't even protect itself to not go extinct or not to collapse in the face of problems and things like that, you know? It's like, if all it took was to not make money off of something like this or off of climate change and to fix it, we would rather make profit and die. So it's like, how do they think they're going to spend their money? I still can't get that one. I mean, they think they're going to Mars. They're going to live in domes or something. They're going to live on their ice train, I guess. I'm glad to see that there's so many union labor actions that have been going on as people have decided that, yeah, it's not worth it to work these shit jobs. After Trump let thousands die from the pandemic, where he was, for the most part, the beginning there, denying there was a pandemic, denying it was as bad as it was, not counting so that the numbers would be low, and even he got it, and God forbid he fucking died from it. And Biden came in as, I don't think people had a lot of hope, but he was just the straighten the course of the ship and pull away from fascism and not let the whole country sink under COVID candidate. And that was too much for him. This promise of vaccines and his promise to capitalists that business would return to normal has been so disastrous. And, you know, way too many refused to take the vaccine. Biden ordered too few tests. He ended the quarantine too soon while it could still come back, and yet it did, and now it's endemic, and, you know, they're forcing children into school to die and bring it home, as I just said, while 5.2 million children have already been orphaned. Think about that. 5.2 million fucking children. Guess what ethnicities and demographics they fall under? I'm not even going to fucking say it. We lost a voluntary, quote unquote, mandate. All it was going to say under certain industries of a certain size of employees was that you had to voluntarily vaccinate, or if you refuse, you have to get tested every week. Make sure you don't have it, because goddamn, you know who took the case to the Supreme Court and fucking won and fucked us all. And they, you know, the government ended relief too soon, just as Omicron has now become Deltacron. And now projections are now saying that we're going to have a massive spike predicted for this spring or this summer. And now they're realizing that, well, because we didn't have enough tests to send out to people, and, you know, because they decided, well, we figured since the vaccine was going to do so well, you're not going to need future tests. How can you plan for these things? There's no way to know you're going to need less tests or less vaccines. What the hell are they doing? I mean, this is not logistics. This is not public health policy. This is politics. You know, this government has completely failed to handle this pandemic, and they have shown that under capitalism, our civilization cannot and will not handle crisis, whether pandemic or climate change. You know, now comes the term democide and why we are experiencing it. For those who do not know, this is a term that I use a lot. It's coined by American political scientist Rudolf Rummel to describe the intentional killing of an unarmed or disarmed person by government agents acting in their authoritative capacity and pursuant to government policy or high command. According to Rummel, the definition covers a wide range of deaths, including forced labor, concentration camp victims, killings by mercenaries and unofficial private groups, KKK, you name it, extrajudicial summary killings. Gee, all the cops killing everybody every fucking year, mass deaths due to government acts of criminal omission and neglect. This such as in, you know, deliberate famines like the Holodomor, as well as killings by de facto governments, like in civil war killings. You know, this definition covers any murder of any number of persons by any government. And he created democide as an extended term to include forms of government murder not covered by genocide. So according to Rummel, democide surpassed war as the leading cause of non-natural death in the 20th century. And this is why Steven Pinker's Better Angels thesis that less people are dying from wars and etc. violence is bullshit. All you have to do is apply this by itself. You apply this plus war, hell, plus carjackings, forget about it. It's the most violent fucking period. Like I've always pointed out, a goddamn McDonald's structurally is very fucking violent. It's violent from how the food is made, the violence of being a wage slave, you know, not being able to eat, all these things. You know, just like being, you know, a supermarket is structural violence. Being homeless is structural violence. And then the cops beat your ass, it becomes, you know, direct violence. And, you know, this, I would say COVID is structural violence at this point, and it's democide. And, you know, I think COVID is also provably utilized to hurry along genocide, as we saw in Trump's concentration camp policies under Stephen Miller, to intentionally kill immigrants in those facilities by getting them sick from the flu, etc., and then later COVID, by denying vaccines to sick children and keeping sick people together so that they would all spread it around and die in those camps. And, you know, we've seen signs that prisons have been doing that as well after a couple years of successful prison strikes. Prisons have allowed COVID to spread, and it's cost the lives of both prisoners and everybody working in the damn prisons. So you have democide as the murder of any person or people by their government, including genocide, politicide, which I would include as coïntel pro, and mass murder. Democide is not necessarily the elimination of an entire cultural group, but rather groups within the country that the government feels the need to be eradicated for political reasons and due to acclaimed future threats, like i.e. immigration policy under Trump, where they planned mass deportations to remove non-whites and to block further non-whites for coming into the country to fulfill great replacement of white genocide paranoia. Those were future threats to white demographics. And I think a lot of these other things that are done are, they kind of keep that in mind of what kind of a threat you're going to be in the future. And, you know, according to Rummel, genocide has three different meanings. The ordinary meaning is murder by government of people due to their national, ethnic, racial, or religious group membership. The legal meaning of genocide refers to the International Treaty on Genocide, the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. And this also includes non-lethal acts that in the end eliminate or greatly hinder the group. I would say possibly sterilization, maybe. Looking back on history, one can see the different variations of democides that have occurred, but it still consists of acts of killing or mass murder. The generalized meaning of genocide is similar to the ordinary meaning, but also includes government killings of political opponents, like I said, coïntel pro, or otherwise intentional murder. In order to avoid confusion over which meaning is intended, Rummel created democide for this third meaning. Now, we are still living in the shadow of an ongoing democide of indigenous peoples, and COVID makes that worse. We're seeing how it's been on the reservations. Rummel estimated that over the centuries, of European colonization, about 2 million to 15 million American indigenous people were victims of democide, excluding military battles, President Jackson, and unintentional deaths in Rummel's definition. Rummel wrote that even if these figures are remotely true, then this still makes the subjugation of the Americas one of the bloodier, centuries-long democides in world history. And it continues to this day. It continues as Native Americans are continued to be able to be treated the way the government treats them and that white people treat them. You know, Rummel stated that his estimate for those killed by colonialism is 50 million persons in the 20th century. This was revised upwards from his initial estimate of 815,000 dead. I say combine those numbers with the estimates from genocide. You know, there's this, again, an ongoing democide of African Americans that began in the transatlantic slave trade, a genocide of colonialism in Africa and the Caribbean, Latinos and Hispanics in Mexico and the Latin America and South America, the pushing out and expelling and deporting of people that happened in the early 20th century. You also have continuing, you know, attacks on Asians and Pacific Islanders after we had the Chinese Exclusion Act and all those exterminations of Asians that have happened here and the Japanese being put in internment camps. All of these events under Article 2 in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. A, killing members of the group. Check. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Check. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Check. D, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Check. E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Check. And they're upgrading that one from to now taking trans children and punishing the parents of trans children. How long till the state doesn't take trans children away from their parents and their families and force them into re-education camps? You know, what do we call allowing this pandemic to rage on and deny vaccines from the global south because of patents, hoarding the vaccines while half of the people fucking refuse to even take the damn shot, allowing thousands a day to die of COVID? We were having a goddamn 9/11 a day for a while there, you know, making whole vulnerable classes expendable, forcing workers to work, forcing children into crowded schools, throwing people out on the streets in a fucking plague. You know, this is the warm-up for the final omnicide of most life on Earth represented by climate change. It just hasn't finished yet.
Yeah, and I guess some people might kind of take it as extreme to say that this is intentional, but I guess the thing to consider would be, you know, go back to colonization of the Americas and colonization in general. You know, the introduction of viruses was a factor in that, and negligence is a political choice. You know, the governments make choices about what needs they address and whether they address them. So yeah, there's you can kill people through negligence, and there is a political calculus that's involved in that.
Yeah, because does neglect have to be on purpose? Technically, I mean, you're not twisting your mustache, going ha ha ha, you know, with your fingers like Mr. Burns, going, oh, I have to kill all these disabled people and all these other people, you know, make sure they all die in enough numbers because of COVID. No.
Yeah, and the point is these deaths aren't inevitable. They are a political choice.
Exactly. That's what's so fucking frightening about it. I think it, to the degree that it's avoidable, that makes it even worse. You know, we can't plan for them all. We can't avoid them all. They can't, just as much as they can't cause them all. But Jesus Christ, I mean, more people can die, though, you know, the more they neglect, the worse the policy, you know. I want to read this real quick part from this book I have that's really good. It's called Crip Zen, A Manual for Survival by Lorenzo Wilson Milam. It's on Crip theory. For disability, radical disability rights. And it starts with, people struggle not only to define themselves, but to avoid being defined by others. But to be a cripple is to learn that one can be defined from outside. Our complaint against society is not that it ignores our presence, but that it ignores our reality. The outline of the shadow we cast has been created not by us, but by those who will find a way to see what they want to see rather than what is there. And that is an excerpt from the book Falling into Life by Leonard Kriegel. And part of what Milam is writing here, how do we face the world that wants us not as ourselves, but as a parody? How do we handle those who want to get us in a place where they can project themselves onto, but not into, our bodies? Project heroism, stick-to-itness, bravery, project sympathy and pity, confusing both with love and approbation. Project everything but reality, never, ever the reality of it. You and I and Kriegel know that we represent, in our public appearances, the truth. Like us, there is not a single one of them out there, the temporary normals, who will not die. And as they do, many of them will preface that dying with crutches, wheelchairs, walkers, and gurneys. To watch us rolling up or bumping past them is to remind them of their fate. A fate they don't want, a fate they think they can, by magic, bypass. James Baldwin once suggested that the roots of racial prejudice come from the fact that blacks were seen as shadows. What he meant by that was that Afro-Americans, with their darker skins, become a projection field, a movie screen, if you will, for whites. Honkies are thus able to lay on blacks their Calvinistic sins, unbridled lust, laziness, lack of responsibility. Through this process, Calvinism and Puritanism become the other face of slavery, and racial prejudice becomes the filter so that people can assign their, quote, darker selves to others, get it off their own backs. And yeah, that lines up with Jung's theory that the Holocaust, that for the Nazis, the Jews represented the shadows for the Nazis, and how they saw the Jews and how they hated the Jews. Now, most of us Crips resent it when they, the normals, use our crutches and wheelchairs, our surrogate bodies, as projection devices for their own insecurities. It turns up in all the things they choose to say to us in the post office, on the street, in the grocery, stories of other Crips they have known, tales of imagined bravery, ours and others, or the simple chins up greeting, you're doing great. Our resentment springs from the fact that we are, at these times, denied the chance to be ourselves. We become, as Kriegel pointed out, what they think we should be.
End of part 1.